From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Eastern Ukraine separatists say they'll form their own army. Tensions are high in Nigeria as Bring Back Our Girls protests are dispersed. Fighting the marriage of girls under 18.
Let the girl get educated and help the family stay stable and you know, more prosperous in the process.
And a quake-damaged U.S. landmark reopens to the public. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Following their controversial referendum on secession, Eastern Ukraine separatist leaders say they will form their own army, adding to the irregular forces appearing across the region. Jamie Detmer reports from Donetsk.
The townsfolk of the small mining town of Krasnomysk had other things on their minds last night when 70 kilometres to their south, separatist leaders in Donetsk came out with a surprisingly early announcement of a landslide majority in favour of seceding from Ukraine. They had just been visited by irregulars who they claim were from the Dnipro Battalion, a pro-unity self-defence force raised in a nearby city by an oligarch offering bounty money for any separatist leader killed. Sergei, a local builder, says he rushed to the town hall where voting had been taking place and saw one person on the ground shot dead. Other shocked locals VOA spoke with said 40 masked gunmen came storming into town and ordered the polling stations to close, and after exchanging words with an angry crowd, the fighters started shooting. A policeman confirmed two people had died. Sergei is exasperated, saying he's for a united Ukraine, but it should not matter whether the region is Ukrainian or Russian or part of Europe or not. He just wants a good life and salary. Even before yesterday's controversial secession referendum, which was dogged with allegations of voter fraud, stuffed ballot boxes and multiple voting, it was difficult for people to stand on the sidelines. Separatist intimidation, abductions and the murder of opponents on one side and punitive raids on the other is forcing people to choose sides, even when they do not want to. And the battle lines are likely to get sharper. Following Sunday's referendum, which has been condemned as a criminal farce by the government in Kiev, but accepted as legitimate by Moscow, separatist leaders in Donetsk say they will form their own army and expect all forces affiliated with Kiev to leave the region. The government is already struggling with its anti-separatist military campaign and is short of men. Analysts say they fear the government is likely to rely on irregulars more, and the fighting could spread beyond the regions, Donetsk and Luhansk, that voted Sunday. Luhansk separatist leader Valery Bolotov, a former paratrooper, says now that their plebiscites are over, his pro-Russian militiamen, as well as separatists from Donetsk, will start turning their attention elsewhere to help other regions agitate for a break from Ukraine. He says separatists will not enter any talks with Kiev, and the only negotiations currently are about prisoner and hostage exchanges. The stage appears to be set for more fighting, increasing the prospects of a Russian intervention. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Donetsk.
Here in Washington, concerns continue about Ukraine's upcoming national elections set for May 25th. VOA's Michael Bowman reports bipartisan support has grown in the U.S. Congress for tougher sanctions against Moscow in hopes of safeguarding Ukraine's democratic exercise.
Referendums went forward Sunday in eastern Ukraine despite widespread statements condemning the votes as illegal and illegitimate. Adding to the tension, no sign Russian President Vladimir Putin is making good on last week's promise to withdraw troops from the Ukrainian border, according to U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel.
Well, they're not leaving, as far as we can tell. You have to ask President Putin as to why he says they're leaving and when, in fact, they're not.
Sanctions imposed by the United States and its NATO allies do not appear to have altered Moscow's aggressive posture towards Ukraine.
Russia continues to isolate itself for a short-term gain. The Russians may feel that somehow they're winning, but the world is not about just short-term.
Well, this is the same playbook that we saw in Crimea playing out in eastern Ukraine. It is an insurgency-type action by the Russians to create unrest.
Republican Senator Kelly Ayotte wants the United States to target entire sectors of the Russian economy before Ukraine's national elections May 25th.
It's time for the administration to issue the sectoral sanctions before the elections so that those elections will not be disrupted so that they can go forward. I believe issuing the sanctions when the elections are interfered with is too late.
Fellow Republican Lindsey Graham wants President Barack Obama to seek formal congressional approval of further punitive measures against Russia.
Instead of doing this by executive order, Mr. President, come to the Congress and see if you could get bipartisan buy-in to sectoral sanctions, which would send a stronger message to Putin. It would hurt the Russian economy more, and I think it would bolster our allies.
I think we should be pushing the Europeans hard for sectoral-based sanctions.
Democratic Senator Chris Murphy agrees Russia must pay a heavier price, but says the United States cannot do it alone.
The fact is that the United States acting unilaterally on sanctions may harm our security interests, not advance them. U.S. sanctions alone are not enough to change the calculus on the ground in Moscow, and ultimately may give political impetus to Putin within Russia to continue his provocations.
Late Saturday, the Obama administration restated its threat to, quote, impose greater costs on Russia, but did not say when it might do so. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
A senior United Nations official accuses the Syrian government of using humanitarian aid as a tactical weapon of war. The director of operations for the Organization for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, John Ging, says 5,000 people are being killed every month, and more than 150,000 people already have died since the war began.
We're becoming numb to the scale and the extent of the brutality of this conflict on ordinary people. So, yes, we are at the limit of what we can do. We're at the limit. Our colleagues are putting their lives on the line. Our colleagues are losing their lives in this conflict. And yet we cannot reach millions.
Ging says people in Syria have run out of coping mechanisms. Public facilities, education, health, and other services are collapsing. He says people are reduced to the very basics of survival. He says the number of people wounded in the war is escalating, but they are not receiving the treatment they desperately need. He calls this an abomination and puts the blame on the government of President Bashar al-Assad.
Denying humanitarian access is a tactic in this conflict, and starvation, increasing the misery of those in places that are besieged, places that are denied access to humanitarian assistance, is a tactic that is being utilized, and it's not acceptable. In terms of who are taking the medical supplies out of the convoys, it's the government of Syria.
Ging is appealing to the international community for support. He says people need outside help to get food, water, medical care, and other essential supplies. He says aid agencies are doing their best, but there is only so much they can do without money. Pakistan is pressing ahead with expanding its nuclear energy and nuclear weapons programs, despite worries from international observers over their safety. Some argue that Washington should strike a deal to share civilian nuclear technology if Islamabad meets certain safeguards similar to the U.S. deal with India. But the chief of Pakistan's nuclear agency suggests he prefers to work with China. Ayaz Ghul reports from the Pakistani capital.
Foreign analysts who study Pakistan's nuclear weapons program find much to worry about. Dr. Peter Levoy recently retired as the U.S. Acting Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asian and Pacific Security Affairs. During a conference in Islamabad this month, he detailed the weapons technology many outside analysts believe Pakistan is developing.
Today, Pakistan's nuclear weapons trajectory is the single most troubling concern in Washington and in other capitals. In particular, I'm referring to the expansion of Pakistan's nuclear weapons program to include efforts to significantly increase fissile material production, to design and fabricate multiple nuclear warheads with varying sizes and yields, to develop, test, and ultimately deploy a wide variety of delivery systems with a wide range to include battlefield range ballistics delivery systems, or tactical nuclear weapons, as they're often called.
For many, the bigger worry than the technology itself is who controls it. During the 1980s and 1990s, the father of Pakistan's nuclear program, A.Q. Khan, built a proliferation network that secretly aided nuclear programs in Iran, Libya, and North Korea. Pakistan military's ties with militant groups opposed to India and the Kabul regime served as an additional worry for the international community. Mark Fitzpatrick of the UK-based International Institute for Strategic Studies, however, says Islamabad has since taken commendable steps to safeguard its nuclear assets and should be allowed broader access to civilian nuclear technology.
The time has come to offer Pakistan a nuclear cooperation deal akin to India's. Providing a formula for nuclear normalization is the most powerful tool Western nations can use to positively shape Pakistan's nuclear posture. Offering nuclear legitimacy is also the most effective way to communicate that the United States and its allies do not seek to forcefully disarm Pakistan.
He says Pakistan has already met most of the conditions that were required of India in its agreement with the United States, including separating military and civilian nuclear facilities, observing a moratorium on nuclear testing, and tightening export controls. Pakistani officials have lately stepped up efforts to seek such a civilian nuclear deal with Washington to overcome its energy crisis. But surprisingly, speaking at the conference in Islamabad, Chairman of Pakistan's Atomic Energy Commission, Ansar Parvez, said he recommends against such an agreement, suggesting Islamabad is better off relying on China.
If you are going to buy a nuclear power plant from a country, you must have a very deep understanding with it. You must have a relationship with it. You must make sure that in time of need, they will not leave you. So, as I said, once bitten, twice shy. But now, I don't think that we can gain anything.
Parvez is referring to the United States, which had close relations with Pakistan when both were backing the Afghan insurgency against Soviet occupation forces in the 1980s. After the Soviet withdrawal, relations between Islamabad and Washington worsened, in part over Pakistan's nuclear program and its ties to the Afghan Taliban. Those tensions still exist to this day. China has been a much more reliable ally for Islamabad for decades and provided urgently needed economic and defense cooperation. That includes two nuclear plants that provide around 700 megawatts of electricity. Two more smaller units are under construction. Pakistan officials say its nuclear advancements are meant to ease the country's chronic energy crisis. They say the construction of a 2,200-megawatt nuclear power complex in Karachi with China's assistance is part of those efforts. The $10 billion project is scheduled to be complete in 5 years. Parvez defended the country's nuclear advancements at the International Conference on Nuclear Non-Proliferation in Islamabad. He says Pakistan's acute energy shortages require alternatives to oil and gas.
And it seems that to get out of this mess, we have to use coal, imported or local, or nuclear. These are the only options, the only true options that are available to us in Pakistan in the current day scenario.
Although Pakistan's nuclear weapons program remains shrouded in secrecy, many foreign analysts believe its nuclear arsenal is growing at a faster pace, and by the mid-2020s, it could rank as the world's fourth or fifth biggest stockpile. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Tensions are high in Nigeria, 4 weeks after hundreds of schoolgirls were kidnapped by Islamist militants. Security forces have broken up protests demanding the rescue of the girls. Authorities say they fear demonstrations in the more volatile parts of Nigeria will spark sectarian violence. Heather Murdoch has details from Abuja.
This is a protest in the Nigerian capital Sunday.
Bring back our girls now and alive!
That quickly turned into this. Before the police dispersed the protesters and the rally ended. Another weekend protest scheduled in Kaduna, a city known for sectarian violence, never happened. After both mosques and churches were attacked, parts of the city are under 24-hour curfew, and all protests are banned. During the weekend, police occupied locations around the city where rallies were planned. Protest organizer Ibrahim Garbawala held a news conference after the rally failed to materialize.
We were shocked even at last night. The venue, which is the Murtala Square, where we agreed that we're going to hold the protest, was already dominated by security personnel with their tankers and heavy machineries.
Wallace says the weaponry on the streets of Kaduna this weekend would better be deployed in the northeast, where security forces are searching for nearly 300 teenage girls, believed to be held hostage in the forest by Islamist militants known as Boko Haram. Kaduna City has long been a hotspot for political and community violence, and nearly 1,000 people were killed there in post-election violence in 2011. As presidential elections approach in 2015, Kaduna residents fear more bloodshed. In Kaduna, anger over general insecurity has intensified since the girls were kidnapped, says Walla.
We are telling people to understand that the crisis in Nigeria, the crisis in Northeast, is not being perpetrated by the poor man,
yes,
but is being perpetrated by the politicians.
Yes.
Security crises in Kaduna, part of Nigeria's Middle Belt, where the mostly Christian South meets the mostly Muslim North, is often attributed to politicians hiring thugs to intimidate or punish voters. In the Northeast, Boko Haram insurgents have killed thousands of people in the past 5 years, including hundreds of schoolchildren. The mid-April kidnapping sparked protests in Nigeria and around the world, demanding the girls' safe return. Officially, the Nigerian government supports the protest movement. Nigerian police spokesperson Frank Mba appeared Monday in Abuja.
The position of the Nigerian police force is clear. Nigerians have got the right to peaceful assembly, to peaceful association, to peaceful protest, as long as they do so within the confines and ambits of the law.
In the past week, the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Canada, China, and Israel have agreed to provide material support for the rescue effort, a task U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel says will be a huge challenge. In a video distributed to journalists last week, the man who claims to lead Boko Haram, Abu Bakr Shekau, says his group is holding the girls as slaves to be sold as wives. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
Some 14 million girls this year will marry before they turn 18, according to Gail Zamaklaman of the Council on Foreign Relations. We spoke with her about her article, High Stakes for Young Lives, Examining Strategies to Stop Child Marriage.
Right now, what you have is a situation in where it is common in much of the world for young girls to face marriage before the age of 18. 1 in 9 girls around the world will actually face marriage before the age of 15. So this is not an isolated practice. And really what the report is trying to do is to show the scale of the issue, and also what are the drivers? What's happening that's making this practice still exist in this point in time in history? The numbers have been coming down of late, but in a lot of parts of the world, they're pretty stubbornly stuck where they are.
Some people would say, what's wrong with child marriage?
You know, we get that a lot. And when I was in Afghanistan reporting, people used to say to me, and I was, when I say people, I would say older foreign people would say, what's wrong with child marriage? And I would say, well, you know, if a 13-year-old girl knows it's wrong for her to have to drop out of school and marry someone twice her age, shouldn't we? I have never interviewed a girl who was put into child marriage, particularly a young girl taken out of school, who went willingly. And the issue is that this is about human capital. It's about talent. It's about global economy, and it's about global stability. It's about whether we will suffocate the talent of young people all around the world as they try to achieve their potential, or whether we will help to foster them to make choices that fit with the lives that they want to live. And almost always in much of the world, these girls drop out of school if they were allowed to go to school in the first place because of marriage and are pretty quickly having children. Maternal mortality is among the leading killers of girls 15 to 19 around the world. Their bodies simply are not ready for it. And a lot of data shows if you can at least wait till 18, it makes a huge difference in both the health of the child and the health of the mother. So we're really talking about healthier families with that are more educated and then consequently more prosperous, which is in everybody's best interest.
You have been researching how the issue is being approached in different regions of the world. Let's just start with what does not work?
I think what does not work is coming in top-down as a foreign agency or organization and saying, boy, you shouldn't do this. This is terrible, without understanding what is driving the practice. You know, in some places, it's tradition. In some places, it's pure economics. And in other places, people just have never had the chance to be exposed through education to the fact that there might be other options for their girl. And so I think taking an approach where you look at what's actually happening, listen to what's actually happening, and then have conversations with people in the community. Most of the time, parents want the best for their children. But this is one of the things that's just sort of always been done. So you have to sort of lay out the menu of other options that might be available and look at what are the economics driving many of these decisions and see if there might be a way to intervene around that way that both lets the girl get educated and helps the family stay stable and more prosperous in the process.
Gail Zamok-Lamon, Senior Fellow for the Women and Foreign Policy Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. Tomorrow, we'll hear about one program that is helping to stop child marriage. The Washington Monument, one of the U.S. Capitol's most recognizable landmarks, was reopened today, 3 years after sustaining earthquake damage. VOA's Victor Beatty reports the 130-year-old, 170-meter-tall marble obelisk sustained more than 150 cracks following a rare 5.8-magnitude earthquake in August 2011.
The monument, located in the heart of the city's National Mall, was shaken by the August 23rd earthquake, whose epicenter was about 145 kilometers southwest of Washington. Falling mortar and pieces of stone struck visitors inside, causing minor injuries. Everyone was safely evacuated. A post-quake assessment revealed cracks, spalls, and displacement of stones and joints, forcing its closure to the public. The structure was covered by scaffolding as it underwent repairs at a cost of $15 million, half of it paid by businessman and philanthropist David Rubenstein. James Perry is with the National Mall and Memorial Parks, an administrative unit of the National Park Service, which oversees the capital city's national memorials.
Most of the earthquake damage that this building sustained back in 2011 was at the upper levels of the monument. So that required a very elaborate scaffolding system and very expert stonemasons who could come and do the repairs here. And here at the ground level, you can actually see a variety of the types of techniques that are used to restore a building like the Washington Monument. So right behind me is what's known as a Dutchman. This is simply a piece of the same type of stone. In this case, it's marble from Maryland, just like much of the rest of the Washington Monument. And where there's a damaged piece of stone, a piece of new stone is cut and shaped and fit in that area.
New exhibits have been installed at the Washington Monument, and visitors can once again ride an elevator to the top, the highest point in the federal city. Construction of the monument, a tribute to the nation's first president, George Washington, began as a private venture in 1848. First, funds ran out, and then the Civil War interrupted building efforts until Congress authorized resumption of construction in 1876. The monument was finally completed in 1884 and dedicated the following year. It was the world's tallest structure until completion of the Eiffel Tower in Paris in 1889 and attracts about 800,000 visitors a year. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. That's voanews.com. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington.